Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today's guest, award-winning writer Elie Mistal, wrote his new book, Bad Law, 10 Popular Laws That Are Ruining America, before the disastrous Biden-Trump debate. He knew that the Democrats were in trouble, and at that time, he decided that if Democrats lost, Bad Law would be his first attempt at writing Project 2029. Republicans started writing Project 2025 in 2021 when they had no power. Elie Mistal says this is the time, when we have no power, to start thinking bigger. The book also includes 10 laws he believes must be repealed, including Stand Your Ground, Illegal Reentry, and the Airline Deregulation Act. He says they must be stopped before we can move forward. Elie Mistal is an award-winning justice correspondent for The Nation, where he covers the courts, the criminal justice system, and politics. He writes The Nation's monthly column, Objection, and hosts their legal podcast, Contempt of Court. He also writes the weekly Nation newsletter, Elie versus U.S. Elie Mistal is also author of the New York Times bestselling book, Allow Me to Retort, A Black Guy's Guide to the Constitution, and we had him on the show when that book came out. If you're in the Bay Area, Elie Mistal will be speaking at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco on Wednesday, April 16th at 6 p.m. You can find information at commonwealthclub.org. Hi, Elie. Thank you for your work, and thank you so much for joining us again.
Thank you so much for having me, Rose. I'm looking forward to my West Coast swing on this book tour.
Well, speaking of book tours, Elie, I was just listening to your recent interview on The Breakfast Club, and you said that for the very first time, you now have security at your book events.
Yes, I do. It is. These are the times we live in, and given what I do. And given the current administration and its the way that it can inflame, this current administration inflames the passions of the very worst people this country has to offer. My publisher and my manager decided that was a necessary precaution.
I'm so sorry that it's come to this. I mean, you're not the only one, but how does that make you feel that you have to have security at a book event?
Not great, Bob. Like, it's not awesome. Right. But you know, you want to take the precaution. Look, if the people that care about me are telling me to take this precaution, you know, I'm trained to listen to them and trust that they have my best interests at heart. But you know, in it doesn't affect like what I say, right? Like, I'm not going to. At least not to this point, nothing's happened that makes me kind of fear speaking. You know, I'm still going in San Francisco, right? I'm still doing my events. I'm not hiding yet. So I'm trying to not, you know, try to have that kind of cognitive dissonance, but in a good way, of putting that in one part of my mind, but, you know, going out there and still doing my thing and speaking my truth, as it were. To anybody who's going to invite me and is willing to wrestle and engage with the ideas that I put forward.
You are very vocal on social media. You're on MSNBC regularly. If I saw you walking down the street, I'd probably stop you and give you a hug and say hi. So I'm sure people recognize you. I mean, what has really changed over the years in terms of the response that you have received both online and in person?
Yeah, well, this is part of Trump's general coarsening of America, right? On the apartheid platform, you know, I get called the N-word, you know, more often than I would like, and more often than 10 years ago. Yeah. For them, free speech is not engaging with ideas or reading books or attending protest rallies. For them, free speech is shouting racial slurs at people they don't like, right? And so, like, whatever, it's not gonna, again, that kind of stuff is not gonna stop me. Most of the reactions that I get when I'm out in public are positive. Most of the people who recognize me from left-leaning type shows or media. And so most of the reactions that I get are positive. I think that the difference kind of post November 5th is that you'll notice a lot more. So put it like this. 5, 6, 7 years ago, if somebody recognized me out on the street and didn't like what I had to say, they might come up and they might be like, you know, hey, I hadn't seen you. I saw you at Tucker Carlson, which whenever I'm on Tucker, what is on Tucker, it was like one, like 20 second clip out of context of what I had said. Right. But, you know, I saw you, Tucker, and I disagree with what you have to say. I think you're wrong about whatever they think I'm wrong about. Right. And then you can kind of deal with those people, especially when those people are, when your kids are not around and it's not dangerous, right? You're like, well, all right, that's your opinion. And I'm always happy to defend my opinions kind of no matter where I am, right? I think the weirder thing post-election is that you see people who are looking at you like with the side eye, but they're not coming up to you, right? They're not actually engaging with you. They're just kind of sneering at you. And that's a little bit disconcerting in a way, right? I would much rather be in a kind of debate with somebody than just have eyes following me around the airport or whatever. So that's a little bit off-putting, if you will. Right. But you know, I'm learning how to, that's new for me, but I'm learning how to deal with that too and just keep on stepping, right? I do wear, you know, when I'm in unfriendly territory now, I wear a hat a lot now, and my hair is such a distinctive part of my look. I got my Mets cap on now a lot more to try to avoid the kind of just visual recognition sometimes. So you know that's a change that I've made. But other than that, I'm just trying to keep doing my thing. And you know, Rose, the other point here is that like they want us to be afraid. They want us to self-censor. They want us to be scared of them. And I try to refuse to give them that satisfaction. They control the government. They control the military. They control the paramilitary. They control the police. They control most all of social media. They control most of the media, either through direct control or through their complicit saps in most of corporate media. They have all of the power right now. The very least that I can do is say, no, that's wrong. Stop. Right? And so I'm not going to give them that final measure of victory over my own mind and over my own voice.
Well, to that point, as I said in the introduction, you wrote this book before the disastrous Biden-Trump debate. And in past interviews, you said you knew that the Democrats were in trouble as you were writing this book. And you decided that if they lost, this book would be your first attempt to write Project 2029. As you say, when Republicans come into office, they smash things. We're seeing that right now. And when Democrats come into office, they come in with super glue. And yep. You say, it's time to also smash things. And your new book is about what you would smash.
100%. Some of these institutional rules, some of these traditional requirements that we have, some of these laws that we have are bad, are actually bad, are actually terrible. They and the science is in on many of the laws that I write about. I think all of the laws that I write about in the book, we have empirical evidence for why they're bad. Why are they still here? Why aren't Democrats, when they have power, when they have a brief window where they control the House and the Senate and the White House, why aren't they repealing some of these things from our past that are clearly bad, that are clearly being used for evil intentions, right? I thought about writing the kind of like 5 constitutional amendments we need to have a super happy, awesome time, right? 10 great laws we should pass. I thought about writing that more kind of positive, happy, clappy version of this book. And there's a really good argument for focusing on new things that we should pass, right? But instead of going in that direction, I was like, look, there are some very obviously bad things that are on the books right now that we could just be rid of, that we could get rid of today and would make our world better tomorrow. And instead of entirely focusing on sometimes science fiction pie in the sky, like, oh, wouldn't it be great if, like, wouldn't it be great if we just took some of these bad laws away? Some of these laws that, again, empirically don't work. Some of the laws that we have evidence for their racial discrimination or their gender discrimination. What if we just got rid of some of our mistakes of the past and freed ourselves from those shackles, right? So, like, that became the focus of my book and the research that I did around it. What can we just get rid of and make things better tomorrow?
Well, and you have also said in past interviews that you were not surprised by the outcome of the presidential election. And this is directly connected to your chapter on airline deregulation, because that is when the Democrats began losing the working class. And it's so easy to just assume that the airline deregulation was all about Ronald Reagan, but that's not true. You write about how Democrats also got on board. You place the birth date of neoliberalism on October 24th, 1978, because that's the day that President Jimmy Carter signed the Airline Deregulation Act into law. So this was every chapter was fascinating, but can you talk about what the context that you learned about the Airline Deregulation Act and how that is directly connected to why the Democrats lost this election?
So deregulation is the theory that the market should take over for basic government responsibilities, governmental responsibilities, right? And, you know, today we call it privatization, right? We talk a lot about, for instance, the privatization of the prison system, like the one in El Salvador, right? Like we talk a lot about privatization, but privatization is just the modern word for deregulation. It's the modern word for taking the government out of providing services and letting the market provide those services instead. And just as we understand today that privatization is a mistake, deregulation was a mistake. It gave the market power over our government as opposed to the government power over our government. And that has huge consequences for our individual abilities to change our government and thus change our society, right? Because when you let the market decide, you're saying that people can vote with their wallets. But when you let people vote with their wallets, the person with the biggest wallets has more votes. The person with the biggest wallet has more power and more influence. When you let the voters decide how they want society to function, then guess what? Technically speaking, at least, it's one man or woman, one vote, right? We all have the exact same voting power. Technically, obviously we don't. If you live in California, you have significantly less voting power than the people in Wyoming. But putting that aside for a second, you technically have a one person, one vote rule. And so when the government is in control of how our society runs, it allows all of us to change how our society runs through the acts of voting and participating in the political process. When you let the market decide, it lets, I don't know, the richest man in the world decide how the country is going to work. Which one do you think is better? I think we're seeing right now why letting the market decide can be so incredibly bad, right? To roll that back into airline deregulation was the first, the airlines were the first industry to be deregulated along these lines. After airline deregulation, it went to first the phone companies and the telecommunications industries. Boy, when people just thought that we were deregulating AT&T, wouldn't it be great if they understood what was about to come around the corner in terms of social media and smartphones, right? But we deregulated the telecommunications industry. We deregulated large swaths of the financial sector. But it all started with the airlines. And so that's why I focused on the Airline Deregulation Act. Now, just to finish the point, Rose, I don't know what your process is. My process generally is when I see something bad, I'm like, bring me the Republicans, right? Show me the mustache twirling evil Republican behind the curtain, and I will tell you how this terrible thing happened. And that was my process when I started researching airline deregulation. And it's my process when I started researching most of the chapters in my book. But again and again and again, while, yes, sure, there is always a mustache-twirling Republican behind the curtain, in so many instances, I started seeing Democrats. Mm-hmm. Democrats supporting the bill, Democrats spearheading the bill, Democrats providing the Republicans the critical votes to get the bill over the line in the House or the Senate. And so the book is called 10 Popular Laws That Are Ruining the Country. And the reason that I use the term popular is because at the time that these laws were passed, that I highlight in the book, most of them received broad bipartisan support at the time of their passage. Both parties agreed that these laws were a good idea. And only belatedly, in most cases, the Democrats be like, oh, whoopsies, probably shouldn't have voted for that. And yet the laws are still on the books.
You write, I cannot say that the Airline Deregulation Act caused many of the bad laws we still live with today. I can say that if you understand how Democrats passed the Airline Deregulation Act, you will understand nearly every effing mistake the Democratic Party has made over the last 50 years.
Yeah, so the thing that happens with deregulation is the thing that always happens with deregulation or privatization. Labor gets gutted. Labor gets smashed. And that's exactly what happened with the airlines. Before deregulation, if you were a labor union working for the airlines, you were a pilot union or you were a baggage handler union, right? You negotiated your collective bargaining with the entire industry as a whole through the regulatory agency. In the airline situation, it was called the Civil Aeronautics Board, the CAB, right? But you, the union, negotiated with the CAB, the government, and the government collective bargaining agreement that you came to was then applied to all the other airlines, right? So the airlines couldn't compete on labor costs. They couldn't have a race to the bottom. But once you deregulate the industry, now the unions have to negotiate with each individual airline carrier, right? And what that means is that you have a race to the bottom where, like, Continental wants to cut wages this way. Eastern wants to cut overtime pay that way. Well, if you don't accept the bargain from Eastern or Continental, well, maybe the whole airline will go under and everybody will lose their job. That happened consistently after deregulation, right? Or maybe the baggage handler union negotiated one deal with Delta, and now you, working for Southwest, feel compelled to take the same deal that they have at Delta because you want Southwest to be able to compete. So it creates a race to the bottom and labor gets gutted. Then you add Ronald Reagan, right? Then you add the destruction of the social safety net that happened under Ronald Reagan, and you have essentially organized labor falling through the cracks. You have organized labor getting eviscerated by corporate barons who are impossibly wealthy. And it's what starts the alienation of labor forces from the Democratic Party. Now, I can argue till I'm blue in the face that the Republican Party is no better. The Republican Party hates labor and doesn't do anything to help labor. And that is, again, empirically true. But what you have are people who are struggling, who are desperate, who are looking for any person to blame for their struggles. And instead of blaming the rich folks who did the work, Republicans offer them immigrants. Exactly. Republicans offer them black people. Republicans offer them women. Republicans say, hey, it's not the corporate barons who are responsible for your pain and misery. It's not the airline executives who cut your wages and took away your overtime pay that are responsible for your misery. It is some dude from Mexico. That's the person you should hate. Right. And labor, white working class labor at least, has unfortunately completely fallen for the okie doke. They've fallen for the ruse. They've given in to their worst instincts. They've given in to their haste, to their hate and racism. And now Democrats are like trying to get them back, right? But well, you're not offering them anything, right? Republicans are offering them hate. Republicans are offering them a reason for their sadness, and they're blaming it on the brown folks. What are Democrats offering? Re-regulation of their industries? No, Democrats aren't offering that. And that's why we lose.
So, okay, given all of that, what you laid out, because in the chapter about airline regulation, you write about a few Democrats who realize that they made a big mistake when they voted for this. But you write, unfortunately, not every Democrat got the memo. Neoliberalism did eventually take over the Democratic Party, capped off by Bill Clinton's 1992 presidential campaign. So this is when Democrats began losing the working class. And this chapter, Ellie, reminded me of Naomi Klein wrote in her last book that Steve Bannon did not want Bernie Sanders to run against Trump, because he would have laid out a very different vision on economics, especially from Trump. But he knew that the Democrats would just kind of give little bits and pieces here and there, but they wouldn't really have a major different economic platform. And so yep. Given that, where do you think the Democratic Party will go from here? Because as AOC says, the Democratic Party is like five different parties. I mean, Joe Manchin's not there anymore, but you've got the Joe Manchin wing. You've got this other moderate wing. You've got someone wanting to do a few good things, but they still might be in favor of regulation that really hurts workers. And then you have AOC and the Bernie wing. So what are your thoughts about how the Democratic Party is going to move forward, given that?
The strength of the current Democratic Party lies with vulnerable communities, people who have been shut out of the Reagan-infused largesse, right? It lies with Black people, it lies with gay people, it lies with women. But the establishment of the Democratic Party has never been comfortable with that. The establishment of the Democratic Party has never been comfortable being a Black party or a gay party. They want to be a white working class party. And so one of the huge things that Democrats are going to have to figure out how to do, and Rose, if I knew how to do it, I wouldn't be talking to you. I'd be running for something, right? So I'm not saying that I had the answer here. And if I did, they would give me some kind of prize in Stockholm. For my intelligence, right? So I'm not claiming to have the full and complete answer here, but at some point the Democratic Party is going to have to get over itself to realize that the white working class has been lost, that they have given in to hate and racism and vitriol, and start building up the parts of the country that hasn't given in to the racism, and then convince it's not about convincing the 77 million people who voted for Trump to come back to the light. They are gone. They are never coming back. There is no, you cannot bring them back to Jesus. They have abandoned you. It's about convincing the 90 million people who stayed on the couch to show up and participate in the democratic process of self-government. That's got to be the democratic focus. And the way to do that is to meld some of these progressive economic ideas like you have with a Bernie Sanders or an AOC, ideas that I generally, just for the record, completely agree with. You have to meld those progressive economic ideas with also a progressive ideas about racial justice and equality. Right. So you can't have your billionaire wealth tax without also having your police reform idea. It's got to be both. Democrats, for the most part, don't want to do that. They establishment Democrats are hostile both to the economic platform and to the racial and social justice platform. And a lot of people who are on the progressive side who are amenable to the economic platform don't want to get into the racial and social justice platform. And until you bridge that gap, until you bring both of those pinchers to bear, both of those fists to bear against the white supremacist junta that Trump is running, you're going to continue to lose to it.
Well, and Ellie, before we go to break, as you know, it's not just the white working class. You know, just to remind listeners, I'm reminding myself of this. I'm reading from an NBC piece back in November that Trump made gains across the country. Asian American communities saw significant rightward shifts. The rightward shift of Black voters in the South exceeded the nation as a whole. Trump got more of the Latino vote this time around. So how are you thinking about that?
When I think about that, I think that I see very clearly that the problem is men, right? That Trump has been able to tap into a toxic masculinity in this country that the Democrats have no response for right now. The Democratic Party is right now, for the most part, led by women. And I don't just mean that in terms of, you know, Hillary Clinton and Kamala Harris and whatever. I mean that if you look up and down the ranks of the party, our strongest leaders, our strongest voices are women. Right. You're not just talking about Harris and Clinton. You're talking about AOC. You're talking about Ayanna Pressley. You're talking about Jasmine Crockett, who's the hottest thing in Congress right now. Well, deservedly. But we're a party led by women. And there are some men who don't like that. And again, if I had the answer for this, Rose, trust me, I wouldn't be hiding the ball. I don't have the full and complete answer for this. But one of the things that is unquestionable that Trump has done is tap into a young male ennui, right? For guys who would kick my ass for saying ennui to their face, right? and we don't have a good response to those guys. We don't have a response, and we're not playing on the platforms where they're getting their news and information. I keep saying, like, I, Rose, just as a aside, I play a lot of video games. I'm kind of a gamer. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I see the kinds of stuff that happens on Twitch or YouTube streamers or whatever, the kind of grooming for toxic masculinity and white supremacy that happens in those forums. And Democrats are almost nowhere on those forums. Liberal people are almost nowhere on those forums. We don't have our liberal Twitch channel where we're playing Call of Duty or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, I made this joke before, but I play this one game called Destiny, and it's like, you know, it's shooting aliens. And when I'm playing with my friends, my college buddies, I'm always the guy in the fire team that's just like, what did these aliens do wrong? We're doing a genocide to these evil aliens. They never had a free trial. Like, it's a joke, right? But it's the kind of liberal sensibility of, like, I don't recall putting these aliens on trial. We're just going to their home planet and shooting them. What's up with that? But that's the kind of thing, that's the kind of, like, slightly subversive, liberal, progressive idea that never gets talked about in these forums, that never gets talked about on the places where young men are playing their video games and getting their information. And until we start speaking there, we're going to keep losing that cohort of voters. And that cohort of voters does, I think, transcend race, right? Mm-hmm. The toxic penis having transcends skin color in this country at this point.
Well, we're going to take a quick break, and after the break, I'd love to continue talking about this because I think it is so important to talk about where young men are hanging out online and then the algorithms they see, the ads they're being fed. We just have to spend more time talking about that. Today, we are speaking with award-winning writer Ellie Mistal. He's out with a new book called Bad Law, 10 Popular Laws That Are Ruining America. These include, as we were talking about, the Airline Deregulation Act. He also says it's time to get rid of Stand Your Ground and illegal reentry. He also writes about a bold agenda for the future, which he is calling Project 2029. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. Today, we're spending the hour with Ellie Mistal, an award-winning columnist and writer. He has a column at The Nation. He also hosts their legal podcast, Contempt of Court. He is out with a new book called Bad Law, 10 Popular Laws That Are Ruining America. Such interesting information about Stand Your Ground, illegal reentry, the Hyde Amendment. We were just talking about the Airline Deregulation Act. He says these laws must be stopped before we can move forward. He also writes about a bold agenda for the future, which he is calling Project 2029. If you have any questions or comments for Ellie Mistal, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Ellie, here at KALW, we are in the middle of our membership campaign. This show also airs on other stations. So if you're listening on another station, I really hope you also support that station. Ellie, as someone who writes books and regularly goes on MSNBC, when you're on book tour, you go on a lot of public radio stations. Can you just talk about the importance of public radio, especially during these times? As you know, the CEO of NPR had to testify in front of Marjorie Taylor Greene. I mean, and was asked such ridiculous questions about communism. I mean, Catherine Marr had to go testify. So can you just talk about the importance of public radio, especially during times like these?
One of the funny things about the Trump administration and the Republicans is that they constantly tell on themselves. And in the situation of public radio, they seem to be so very angry that there aren't enough essentially registered Republicans who are on public radio and are doing those kinds of things. And they say this as if it's an indictment on the public radio ecosystem. And I always want to respond, public radio is kind of devoted to saying things that are true. Your problem is not the public radio ecosystem. Your problem is your inability to tell the truth. Is literally your inability to follow basic journalism standards and tell the truth. Because if you could tell the truth, you'd be on all the public radio you wanted. And you can point to Republicans who do well on public radio, because even though I disagree with them in terms of like their, you know, overall political philosophy, they tell the truth. You know, George Will does not have a problem getting on public radio. Charlie Sykes does not have a problem getting on public radio. And these are Republicans that I disagree with in terms of their like economic philosophy, but they're not liars. And so they can get on shows. The people who can't get on shows are the people who lie, right? If you're going to lie, you need to be on private radio. You need to be advertiser sponsored, right? So Republicans are, I feel, really telling on themselves when it comes to that. But at 30,000 feet, you have to understand Trump's larger attack on the First Amendment. Like I said, for these people, the First Amendment means shouting racial slurs and nothing else. They're not actually invested in the marketplace of ideas or the free exchange of debates and controversy, right? They have no tolerance or time for that. Authoritarians never do. And so Donald Trump and his junta are not committed to the First Amendment. They're not committed to the marketplace of ideas. They're committed to state-run propaganda. So on the media conglomerate that gives them their state-run propaganda, they feel quite comfortable. And any media that doesn't give them their state-run propaganda, they feel attacked and they feel sad. And they're trying to ruin it. They're trying to keep people from hearing competing viewpoints. You know, one of the legal scholars talk about the First Amendment, not just in terms of your ability to produce speech without government retribution. They also talk about the government's ability to drown out speech it doesn't look like with its control of the bully pulpit and every other kind of advantage the government has. And I think that is the threat that Trump, that is the second part of the pincher attack that Trump is trying to do on the First Amendment. He both wants to criminalize and penalize speech, as we see with Palestinian students getting pulled up off the street and sent to black sites. He absolutely wants to criminalize the use of speech, but he also wants to be able to drown out everybody else's speech with his own. And so does the co-president Elon Musk. That's why you spend $45 billion on Twitter, because you're trying to drown out, literally throttle everybody else's speech. I'm very proud. I got banned from Twitter during the run-up and first launch of my book because, you know, Elon Musk doesn't like me, which is fair. I don't like him either. And I'm very proud that my book hit the bestsellers list without me having a Twitter presence, right? I think that that says something about how much people actually need that particular platform. It was only after my book hit the bestsellers list that they let me back on Twitter, because, you know, they want me there for the Fight Club of it all. But like, I was able to get the book on the bestsellers list without using Elon Musk's platform. So again, the point here is that they want to have their speech rise above all others, and things like public radio, things like NPR, are the other avenues that we have to get our message out away from government control and scrutiny, and that's why Trump and the Republicans are trying to kill it.
You know, given all of that, that is why media is so incredibly important right now. How do you think more of the legacy media outlets are covering Trump a second time around? How do you think they're doing so far?
Sniveling cowardice. They are. Look, I don't know if it is just straight cowardice or even worse, sinister complicity. But I know that they refuse to cover Trump aggressively. They will not cover Trump as aggressively as they covered Biden. They didn't cover Trump in the campaign as aggressively as they covered Harris or Biden. They are terrified of him. And they, what's the word I'm looking for? Because it doesn't affect them. And it's weird for them to think that, because anybody paying attention must know or should know that Trump's attacks on the First Amendment are not going to stop with Palestinian students and public radio. They must know that those attacks, the nature of fascism, the nature of authoritarianism is to always overplay its hand, to keep growing and growing and growing until there's nobody left to stop them, right? But for right now, mainstream media, corporate media thinks that they will be protected from Trump as long as they bend their knees. And so that's what they're doing, despite every evidence that appeasement doesn't work with authoritarians. Showing authoritarians your belly doesn't actually work. But they're doing that anyway. And that's, I think, explains a lot of the coverage currently from mainstream media. They're afraid of him. They won't call a spade a spade.
Today, we're speaking with Elie Mystal. He's out with a new best-selling book, Bad Law, 10 Popular Laws That Are Ruining America. He's also author of Allow Me to Retort, A Black Guy's Guide to the Constitution. He's an award-winning justice correspondent for The Nation. He writes a monthly column there and hosts the legal podcast Contempt of Court. If you're in the Bay Area, Elie will be speaking at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco Wednesday, April 16th at 6 p.m. Find information at commonwealthclub.org. Let's hear from a few callers who've been waiting patiently, Marion and Monterey. Hi, Marion. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Hi, Elie. I'm an admirer of yours. And so therefore, I think that knowing your personality, I'm going to push back against some of what you said. I agree with a lot of things you said. However, I think that you're well-spirited enough to hear what I have to say. And so, first of all, we know that there's a lack of messaging when it comes to the Democratic Party in reaching out to the working class, just reaching out. We've taken people for granted for a long time. And I say that as somebody who works in communities. And I'll just kind of give you an example of how we take people for granted and we talk down to them. Even just earlier, I heard you say that males hear you say that they would kick your ass if they heard you say the word ornery. just even right there, it's sort of like I'm up here, you're down there, because you don't even know what I'm talking about, and I'm doing a Jane Austen to you, talking right over your head. And so this party is being run, as we, you know, as we can say, by very old neoliberal Democrats like Schumer, like, you know, Blumenthal in himself, even Cory Booker with his just what I'm going to call virtue signaling of 25 hours, in which he goes up there and it's like, let's Cory Booker this. But it did nothing to gain my attention, because where has Cory Booker been when people have been calling out? And he's been part of the problem, you know, with part of the Zionist message. This past election, where people were screaming out, stop fighting wars, concentrate on people at home, all of these things that were just so ignored, and then sending out someone to run for president that wasn't chosen by anybody except the very delegates who chose those people to begin with. And so the American people aren't stupid, and they get talked to as if they're dumb, but they're not. They're just not being heard, and they don't really care to listen to either party anymore. Mm. So the vote that sat down is a vote that sat down and was sending a message to both parties. It's like, we think you're all the same. We don't think you're listening to us. Stop telling me that you're blue while you virtue signal things. You're concentrating on the wrong stuff.
Well, Marianne, thank you for the comment. We're almost out of time, but Ellie, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, so a couple of things, and I appreciate the call from Marianne. But first of all, I disagree that people are just tuning out both parties. They're not. They're not tuning out the Republicans. They're not tuning out the party that is serving them up racism and misogyny. They are listening with both ears to that stuff, and they're voting for it, right? So that's number one. Number two, I think that you slightly misunderstood what my point of making the ennui joke. My point with that is that I am kind of in a perfect example of a person who does not have a great message for working class people. I am a Northeastern liberal effete elite. I'm not the guy you need out front when you're talking to a certain kind of American voter, right? The Democratic Party needs to have people who can both speak to people like me and, again, speak to the people who would kick my ass. And we have those people. We don't always forward them. We don't put them out front enough. We don't give them enough room and enough rope to go do what they have to do to get those people. And that's what I'm saying is the divide that the party needs to bridge. You've got to find a way to both get me and get the person who would beat my ass. Like, that actually is a political thing that we need to do, right? And so that's on the ennui point. On the last, I think, overall point, I don't actually disagree with a lot of what Miriam had to say. I do think the Democratic Party takes people for granted, doesn't listen to their concerns enough, shows up. Certainly, look, I'm Black. They show up in my community once every 4 years for like 3 weeks and be like, oh, now it's time for you to vote for us again, and then ignore us for the other 3.5 years. So I totally agree that the Democratic Party tends to take constituencies and groups and communities for granted. And I think that's a huge problem that we have and we need to overcome. I just disagree with the idea that that people are tuning out both parties. They are not. I saw, and I'll end with this, Rose. I saw a major party candidate for president drive around in a garbage truck for the last week of his campaign, analogizing himself to literal trash. And I saw his voters eat it up. I thought, oh my God, we're going to vote for the trash. Yeah. Oh, USA, USA. And I'm like, what the heck is going on? Democrats have no counter to trash at this point. And it's one of the reasons why we fail. And again, if I had an answer for how we overcome the trash, trust me, I wouldn't be hiding the ball. But somehow we have to speak to people who would vote for literal trash and speak to people who like to read books. And it's a problem the Democratic Party hasn't yet figured out.
Well, thank you for the call, Marianne. Let's go next quickly to Greg in Palo Alto. We're almost out of time, Greg. But what question do you have for Ellie?
Okay, I'll try to make this as brief as I can. I think that one of the problems is that the Democrats are really stuck as being, you know, the other side of a capitalist economy. They can't offer to people what people need because they're stuck. They're capitalists. That's what they are. And they can't offer. That's why young people, what did they offer to young people? What did they offer to anybody in the last election? Other than, you know, the same old nonsense that we get. And the Democratic leadership is just absolutely pathetic. So unless they can come up with a program that really deals with the needs of these people and that, you know, would benefit these young people that you were talking about, I just don't see them having a future, I mean, in terms of changing things.
Thanks, Greg. Look, I don't, again, I don't disagree with what you said. And one of the reasons I wrote the book in the way that I did is that I didn't want to write another Orange Man Bad book, right? Mm-hmm. Again, Trump drove around in a garbage truck. The fact that he is trash has been baked in to the political electorate for 8 years now. People have decided that they are okay with his trashy offers, right? So just saying, oh, Trump is a really bad guy, that doesn't get me anywhere. So I tried to write about things that Democrats could actually do, that we could actually do, that would change and affect and help people's lives. And I definitely agree with Greg, that there needs to be more of a focus on that, things that are going to help people, to change people's lives, to change the structure of people's lives, more than simply trying to fight the cult of personality with our own cult of personality. That's not going to work. Again, I know that there are some Democrats who are trying. And so, like, I don't want to throw the entire party under the same bus. There are some who are trying. They are generally on the younger side of the party. But there are people who are trying. They just kind of can't get through the establishment cap on their actions. And it's one of the reasons that I've been saying while I've been out on tour, Rose, that for me, the next most important election is the midterm elections. And it's not even the actual general election in the midterms. It's the actual primaries. Some of these Democratic establishment candidates in the primaries, some of these Democratic incumbent establishment candidates in the primaries need to get beat, need to get primaried out, because that will tell the whole rest of the Democratic Party that they have to take the new emerging young people far more seriously. And I know that, I'm not making that up, because that is what the Tea Party did. The Tea Party, which is what became the MAGA Party, did not announce itself by beating a Democrat. They announced themselves by beating a Republican in a primary. Eric Cantor, a young, up-and-coming leadership Republican in Virginia, and the Tea Party took his ass out in a primary. They lost the seat because it was a purple district. And they put up a crazy Tea Party Republican, and the Republican lost the seat. But they took out Cantor, and that told the whole rest of the Republican establishment that they had to take the Tea Party seriously.
Right.
Democrats need to have one of those moments in this upcoming 2026 primary. Some of these people who are insufficiently committed to fighting fascism need to get got in the primary.
Well, just quickly, you reminded me of what happened in, I believe it was South Texas, when Nancy Pelosi put her money and her just her power behind the more conservative Democrat rather than the young progressive woman Democrat.
Yes.
So there's just so much there, Ellie, with this party. Right. And he won. I'm
you
sorry. Their names are escaping me, but the conservative won over the progressive young woman.
You've got to start taking some of these people out at the primary level. And if that means that you might lose some seats in the general, like that's in 2026, that to me is a worthy trade.
Mm-hmm. Ellie Mistal is author of the new book, Bad Law, 10 Popular Laws That Are Ruining America. If you're in the Bay Area, you can hear Ellie speak more about these issues at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco, Wednesday, April 16th at 6 p.m. Ellie, thank you for your work, and we'd love to have you back because we just scratched the surface of your new
book.
Thank
you so much for having me, Rose.
Thank you.
I love coming on your show. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Enjoy your book tour. Be safe. And thank you so much for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.